Hi, I am Raina Sinclair, and this is another episode of Defend Your Ship.
And I am Stevie. And Raina, are you ready to get wrecked this week?
As always,
As always, yes.
this week we have one of my wonderful colleagues as our guest, the amazing, the fantastic, the producer of White Elephant Burlesque, Victor Devon.
Hello, calling in from Riverside, California.
Yay! We are officially bi-coastal.
Yes,
We made
indeed.
it,
y'all. My pleasure. Thank you so much for asking me on. I have a I thought about it because when Raina first explained it to me, because again, Raina mentioned that we know each other through the burlesque world. I thought about it. I'm like, oh yeah, because we work in an industry that's like nerdlesque heavy, or we work in an industry that has a lot of references in what we do because burlesque is very responsive to pop culture. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I don't know if I mean, I've always been very pop culture friendly, but fandom, I'm like, no. I'm forgetting that I have a deep root with fan work in my own way. So I'm looking forward to re-embracing that with both of you today.
Yay! I mean, I'm always down to talk about nerdy shit, as you know. So, thank you for really doing this
My pleasure.
in the time of quarantine.
Exactly. Well, this is I recorded an episode. I do a podcast called We Burlesque, which Raina has actually been on. And it's my opportunity to reconnect with burlesquers in a way that backstage never allows. And what's so funny is, especially now more than ever, it is literally the only way that I'm communicating with people. So I embrace the podcasting during quarantine. So
Yes. We need something to keep the hope alive.
indeed.
So, we always start with our weekly segment of what are you into this week or today, last 48 hours, anything fandom or pop culture related.
One of the benefits of my husband working from home and me working from home is that even though we're passing ships even during the day, because we're both on two different laptops in two different rooms, that we get to spend the evenings together. So we've been catching up on a couple of shows that we've been told to watch, and we finally finished seasons 1 through 5 of Schitt's Creek. And
Oh, wonderful.
I knew that I would love it, but the problem was is I didn't know how much time I wanted to dedicate in one chunk because I knew I needed to consume it like in a row. And that's one thing that gets me about series a lot of times. I'm like, oh, 22 episodes per season and it's this long. Okay, let's see. How much time do I want to dedicate? And sometimes it's just easier to go back to old favorites. And now there was no excuse. So we just finished that, and we're just starting season 2 of Castle Rock, which is the Stephen King influenced world. And this season has to do with misery, which I'm excited about because I love me
Ooh.
a strong, psychologically damaged female character that for some reason has always resonated with me. And Lizzie Kaplan, who most people will either know from Mean Girls, or things like Cloverfield, and she had a series on HBO. She is playing Annie Wilkes, and it is excellent. She is excellent in it. So, recommended, only halfway through, but recommended.
I've heard good things about it. I just haven't, it's on my list with many other things.
I was worried because I like Stephen King to a degree, but I'm not. I don't love him as an author, so therefore it's really what happens is I love The Shining and I love like interpretations of his work. His work itself doesn't really matter to me. And more often than not, like even It or something like that, the only reason I was connected to It in the first place was because Tim Curry was in it. It didn't matter that it was a Stephen King property. So this show, I was a little like, okay, how much do I have to care? And fortunately, it's sort of like a remix. It's sort of like, it's basically fan fiction. It's like someone took all of the characters and all of the set, the world building that Stephen King took the time to do, and then had someone else write it, which frankly is my best case scenario for him. So,
I mean, I often agree because Stephen King is very hit or miss and he doesn't know how to edit.
Well, there are also like, I think a good decades where it was like a lot of coke. Like, I think it depends on where along the lines you check in. And then like some authors, like at a certain point, I think you sort of forget your own bullshit, and then you just sort of try to write for your audience too much, if that makes sense. A little too much fan service. So
yeah, that's fair. What are you into this week, Stevie?
Oh, what a marvelous question. I feel like I haven't been doing a lot of fan content this week because I've been really busy repeatedly taking a how many countries of the world can you name in 12 minutes quiz. So that's been my entertainment this week. I almost managed all of them. I got 193 last night.
Very impressive.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I've been working very, very hard. yeah.
Do you know who Lindsay Ellis is, Victor?
Not off the top of my head.
She's a film critic. She has a lot of videos on YouTube. She did a like 50-minute diatribe about the Cats movie and how Cats the musical turned into Cats the movie musical and what is wrong with it.
So is she pro Cats the movie or anti Cats the movie?
I think a little bit of both.
Okay. All right, good. As long as there's gray area. Okay.
But yeah, she also started a podcast recently with one of her film friends called Musical Splaining, where she is a diehard musical fan and he hates musicals. And so they were going to musicals and then they discussed whether or not he liked the musical.
Okay. As a newcomer to the
and
field.
Yes. Yes. And so I haven't really been paying attention, but I know that Broadway has been releasing some online performances of various musicals to the public as a way to essentially raise money for all of the actors and crew and people that are being furloughed. And Andrew Lloyd Webber in particular has been doing this with his musicals. And last week, he screened on YouTube the Australian filming of his musical Love Never Dies, which if neither of you have heard of that.
Oh my. Oh yes.
Never seen it or listened to any of the music, but I do know what it is.
It's basically the fan fiction sequel to Phantom of the Opera. And Lindsay Ellis's favorite musical of all time is Phantom of the Opera. And so she did sort of a live screening on Twitch of her and her friends roasting the musical. And I had never seen it either. I had only heard of it. And woof. It was rough, buddy.
I believe you. What I have listened to, I don't think I've listened to the entire soundtrack, but I have listened to bits of it. What was your most, which part made you go, whoa, the hardest?
I mean, all of it.
It was all whoa from start to finish. It was all right.
It's a filmed stage play, right? So it's a pro shot, but it's multi-camera angle and everyone's just singing live, right?
Yeah, it was filmed in Australia. Apparently they had like an international tour in 2010, 2011, something like that. And so, yeah, it was a pro shot that they put on YouTube and Lindsay Ellis did a Twitch stream of it. So it was like the YouTube stream, but also her friends making fun.
Not of,
commentary. While also explaining exactly how Love Never Dies came to be, and also just having like chats, and it was funny, especially because I didn't realize that like the whole thing is supposed to take place on Coney Island.
Yeah.
You didn't realize.
And it's just, I don't know. It was this weird thing. Like, I mean, I love Coney Island and I go there all the time when I can. So it was just kind of this weird feeling of like fanfic on Coney Island.
Well, it's really like fanfic on top of fanfic on top of fanfic, because it was originally a book that was then made into a play, then it was then made into a musical, which then got a sequel. Like, it's a lot of layers.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And apparently Andrew Lloyd Webber, like, for Love Never Dies, asked his favorite author to make a book that he then turned into this musical. And it's,
that is a lot of layers.
It's never been on Broadway. It's like apparently one of the few Webber musicals that has never been on Broadway.
I did it in London. I don't think it was successful. So I think I don't think
Yeah.
Yeah, it was not. Yeah.
Basically, all you need to know about it is that the Phantom moved to Coney Island to start a freak show. He gets Christine to show up and sing. And you find out that Christine's child with Raoul was actually the love child of her and the Phantom, because they had sex once 10 years ago.
That's all it takes. Didn't you see any after school specials growing up? It's really more of a PSA. So, I mean, if you.
Yeah. So it was a time. It was a time, y'all.
They're doing
Thank
like
you
a,
for sharing
a,
this
a I think they're one of the reasons they're showing these musicals is because they're also trying to get people onto like the Netflix of Broadway, which is Broadway HD. I think it's on there. So they're probably like trying to like push some of the more palatable things that people might be lured into, and then try to get people to buy into that, I guess.
That's fair. I know that this specific YouTube channel was just all Lloyd Webber stuff. And so like they were like doing his greatest hits. And it was, I think they mentioned at one point, cause they were doing like donations throughout the stream on the YouTube channel. And like the Phantom of the Opera one got like something like $100,000. And then Love Never Dies, I think, only got something like 2,000, 3,000.
You know, it's nothing like a millionaire playwright telling people to donate money. There's nothing quite like that. There's something.
Oh. I don't know. It's. I just was there for the flame war. I just wanted to see it get roasted, and I did not get disappointed.
Well, on that note, shall we transition into the main event of our podcast today?
Yes, let's do that. So, yeah. Victor, how did you get into fandom?
Well, when I was a young warthog, I communicated with my family at dinner or with friends was through the movies that we saw or the TV that we watched or the articles that were written in the arts and entertainment section of Time and Newsweek, which my parents got, or the New York Times, which had the whole arts and leisure section was, there were like pages and pages of black and white ink, sticky like ink, like you pressed on it and it would cover your hands, of these of films, and I would see like the movie posters and be fascinated. I used to hang them on my wall. I remember distinctly having Batman, Michelle Pfeiffer and the Penguin, Batman, Catwoman and the Penguin from Batman Returns, because they had Warner Brothers had bought like a 4-page spread of to advertise Batman Returns. So it was through that. When I was able to figure it out. Like some films like Clue, which is still my number one favorite film, I started writing as those characters, started writing what essentially would end up being, would be referred to as fan fiction, although that term didn't exist. I thought I was just writing stories. And to me, that wasn't odd because I knew that Snow White and Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty were all characters that were relatively, you know, public domain, and Disney just wrote their version. So I thought, why don't I write my version? And they did all the work for me because they did all this world building. They already told me what they were like, so I didn't have to worry about character development. I mean, I was 5 or 6 or 7. And I did this throughout much of my childhood, and I did it with a lot of films or TV shows. And my number one icon, as it were, that I look at is Madonna. And Madonna has made an entire 30-plus year career out of references. She's an incredibly smart woman when it comes to what she puts out there in music video form or in song form or in her tours. And a lot of them have to do with old Hollywood, which resonated with me as a child, which then carried into my adulthood. And a lot of them were sort of like her takes on it. And you can see this in like the Express Yourself video, which is based on Metropolis, the movie. You can see this in her film work when she does Dick Tracy. A lot of that was stylized that way. So my fandoms were really cultivated by, and my association with them was what I could interpret out of them. So yeah, I would say that very early on, things like that got my head spinning, and I cannot say that I have any of them left. It is distinctly possible that my mom does in a folder in a box in the attic that I will someday have to look at.
Look at your shame.
I look forward to having that experience. Yeah, I'm sure that'll be delightful.
But I mean, all of that was just, I mean, a lot of that was just simply, and when I say stories or slash, like we're talking like lined paper of maybe 5 pages. We're not talking epics here. So.
I mean, it takes all kinds.
I mean, even that carried into when I did Rocky Horror for 7 years, because you are playing someone else. And if you're doing it live in front of the movie screen, then the question is, what can you do on stage that not only competes with what's on the screen, but entertains the audience differently? So we would do theme nights. We would dress up differently. There were visual gags. So that was sort of like writing fan fiction in front of the actual property for an audience live. Yeah, it's like the ultimate meta.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of Rocky Horror like that at all. And that's amazing. Like that makes me want to go see a show.
Was very formative. I wouldn't be talking to you now had I not had my Rocky Horror experience, because that directly led to my burlesque world, but indirectly led to me being comfortable in my own skin. So yeah. That's I think people forget that Rocky Horror is essentially a burlesque, nerdlesque live showing, because lingerie aside, you're taking on characterization and you're either trying to reinterpret it or you're trying to look exactly like the characters. That's cosplay.
Mm-hmm. I never thought about it that way before. You learn something new every day.
I stand by it. I stand by it.
Yeah, no, it's solid. And I think I've always seen Rocky Horror as being something there, like in that queer nerd space. Like so many people that I know who are queer nerds either have been in Rocky Horror, have gone to Rocky Horror, really love the movie Rocky Horror. I'll meet people just out that are friends of my other nerdy queer friends, and suddenly it'll be like, oh, okay, and you're in a shadow cast too.
Yeah, there's
all
actually
right.
Quite a few burlesque colleagues in the neo-burlesque current New York situation especially, but all over the world. Southern California even has a lot of overlap with people who are in the local cast and who also do burlesque professionally.
Yeah, I think well, it's interesting for me because I only ever actually saw Rocky Horror Live once. I always would just watch the movie with my friends, and the one time I did go to see it live, there was a burlesquer that I knew in the cast, and it wasn't even like I specifically went to see them. It was I was going to a birthday showing with Kita St. Cyr, and then I turned to Betty Brash and I was like, "Is that Q Magister? I think that's Q Magister." And they were playing Riff Raff, so it's a very small world of Rocky Horror
It's, I
fandom.
mean, it's, it is a probably one of the, it is definitely in the list of very important queer media because it is written by a queer person. Richard O'Brien was married to a woman, but has since, I don't know, I guess it gets hazy because Richard O'Brien has never fully asserted himself as a queer person, as far as I understand it, but it still made a connection with that audience, definitely. And even though Tim Curry has never gone on record about his sexuality, there's a sense that he may also be part of the community. And there's just, I know people who have very visceral responses to it, good things and bad things. And I have a, I could just as easily have done Rocky Horror for this podcast when you were asked, when I was asked to quote unquote defend my shit. But, and I will come back if no one does it in another 20 some episodes, I will. Because I have some very strong opinions about that universe.
I mean, we are always down for some very strong
Absolutely true. So if we're not talking
Yes.
about Rocky Horror today, what is on the table? What
Well,
are you
I
going to
was
defend?
asked to if I had any ships or characterizations that, you know, spoke to me as an adult or as a child that I still held on to. And I chose Homer and Marge Simpson for my ship.
Amazing.
Which I was very intrigued by because I don't usually, I guess like because for me the Simpsons have like, I mean we often make fun of the fact that you have a good decade on me, but the Simpsons is kind of just something that's always
Oh yeah.
existed in the
Oh
background
yeah.
of the world
Yeah, no,
for me.
The
So I've
Simpsons
never
is a millennial.
really
That's how old it is. It's 30
yeah.
something. Yeah.
Woohoo.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Simpsons is
Yeah.
older than me.
I think The Simpsons is also older than me, and I was not allowed to watch The Simpsons when I was growing up. So I have still never seen it. I've seen like GIF sets on Tumblr, and
Oh,
that's as
okay.
far as
Do you have
I've
Disney
come.
Plus?
Wait, no, I've seen the Aurora Borealis thing.
Yes,
That's a Simpsons
steamed
thing,
hams.
right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Steamed hams. Got that. Great.
It's on Disney Plus. The entire series, except for the Michael Jackson episode, is on Disney Plus.
I know. I love how you specifically know which
Well, I mean,
episode is
it
not
was
on
something of
there.
a controversial decision, but it was a decision made by the film by the showmakers, the showrunners, and it wasn't decided by Disney Plus. So they just didn't upload that to the server. Yeah. And but to
Huh.
be perfectly
That's
honest,
fair.
they waited until the documentary that came out about Michael Jackson for them to do that, which frankly, if you hadn't formed an opinion on where you stand with that, it's a either a little late or it's a little performative, depending on your point of view.
I mean, fair. That's true. So, how did you start shipping Marge and Homer? And also, how did you kind of get into shipping in
Oh, well,
general?
I mean, shipping comes out of the fandoms that I was associated with. So it would either be right on the screen, or it would be how I would assume most people decide who they pair up, which is based on what makes sense for them, what is wish fulfillment that you wish they had that opportunity, subtext, not to get like all like, you know, academic on the subject, but I mean, there's it's there for a reason, and it's all I'm pro fandom. I'm not one of those people who is sort of like, it's not what the author meant. I don't care what the author meant. And frankly, sometimes the author isn't being honest about what they meant. If that was true, then there wouldn't be like a lot of like racial stereotypes that fall into our media. There wouldn't be a lot of really fucked up shit that comes out. And then the author's like, I didn't mean it that way. Yeah, but it happened. So, not only was I a young warthog, but I was a young gay warthog. And one of the things that you, that when I shouldn't say you, because times have changed to a degree. When I was growing up, there wasn't a lot of media that was directly referencing my own identity and my own desires. So even as a prepubescent or adolescent person who was realizing his identity, I was getting a lot of heteronormative and a lot of straight relationships represented, and I was cool with that. I didn't have a problem. I was usually more on the side of the woman, but it's one reason that I listen to a lot of women singers than men singers, because a lot of what they're singing about makes more sense to me. But and I think that's why a lot of gay guys have divas and like their number one female musician. You don't have to change the pronouns. You're good. So a lot of that was, you sort of ship people that you wish would have been together if the movie had been made that way and two guys could be together. Or when the internet was in its infancy, one of the things that would be written, which I guess it is a form of fan fiction, would be erotica or erotic stories that would either be completely original and someone would write and they would be posted on the internet on a number of channels or message boards. And a lot of them were also written about celebrities, or a lot of them were written about movie characters or TV characters. And so that was one way, as a young gay guy, teenager, who could see, you know, Dawson's Creek framed in that way if they felt like it. So shipping sort of came very naturally in that regard, because it was fun and it was fantasy. And particularly for a 15-year-old, 16-year-old, it was hot, and that was really all I needed at that time. I can't say it was really for like literary merit, but it was meant to titillate, and it succeeded.
Yeah, I like that that you had an avenue into like fan fiction erotica that wasn't necessarily labeled as fan fiction.
No, typically not. In fact, I didn't know that term until someone mentioned fanfiction.net, I believe. I don't know if that's still around.
Mm-hmm. It is around. Well, yes, it's still around.
I remember someone, Tom, that always seemed to me a little bit more in depth, again, more world building, more. I mean, obviously, I know like the famous Maya Mortal, I'm familiar with at least that. I'm also familiar with, I think it's one of the more early recognized Star Trek fics with Spock and Kirk. The only reason I know it is because I in the Rocky Horror circles, I was friends with people who were Star Trek fans, and someone did it as like a spoken word once, as like a pre-show. And
oh, that's beautiful.
I don't remember a lot of the specifics, but they have sex, basically. But it is like really elaborate and really graphic. So, yeah.
Good. Yeah, I mean that for Spock and Kirk. Love that.
Yeah.
So where, if you don't mind me asking, where were you finding erotica on the internet then? I'm curious for anthropological reasons.
This was back in the day, excuse me, when you had things like Ask Jeeves, where you could actually ask a question and it would give you the result like in a drop down. So you can look.
Oh my God, could you ask Jeeves? Like Jeeves, you
would actually ask Jeeves the same way people now ask Google or Alexa. Yeah.
Oh my God.
And then Jeeves became, well, I think when they started having better results, or it's also distinctly possible because they started to bend to the pressures of limiting what was available to underage. Because I would like to point out, I was underage at that time. So, I mean,
who among us has not been underage, looking up, asking Jeeves titillating questions?
Well, I mean, that was the world. That was what was available. And especially, I mean, I'm very fortunate to come from a very accepting family, but for a lot of queer youth, the only way of them communicating with anything is in a fairly hypersexual internet experience. No judgments, good or bad, on that, but that's usually the way, because it's the only thing that they can access. Again, things are a little bit easier now, but not for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned that, because I think in finding fan fiction communities specifically for myself, there was, like you said, a lot more world building and, you know, more elaborate storytelling. And so we would have stuff that was straight erotica, which we just call porn without plot, PWP. And that's just straight, you know, they're going to fuck, it's going to be 2,000 words, you're going to be happy, everybody goes home happy. Or you could read just like 100,000 words where nothing happens, but they stare at each other longingly for, you know, several pages. And I was very into that when
very
I was
very like
15.
Romance novel.
Yes.
Maybe with like fewer like
and
like, you know, about it.
No Rick Bottas, exactly. Yeah. Yes. So given all of this talk about sexuality and erotica, I'm really curious where Homer and Marge fit in here, because those are two characters
told that this specifically had to be sexual. I wasn't told that.
It doesn't. Oh, my apologies. You've got the right impression of it, but I apologize.
I will say that the show does go out of its way to present Marge and Homer as having a very healthy sex life and having a fulfilling sex life. It doesn't do it in an extraordinarily explicit way, but there are little odds and ends. There's an episode, it's a later season, but it's still canon, where they wake up after a Valentine's Day and Homer falls off the bed and his foot is still tied to one of the bedposts. It's a quick thing. They don't even reference it. It's just an eye contact moment between the two of them. Marge also refers to lovemaking as snuggling. And a number of episodes have to do with sex. So there's a whole episode where they're not getting off, and they end up having sex in a public place, and it turns the juices back on for them, and suddenly that's their thing for the episode, is trying to go location to location until it gets to be too much, and that's the joke, like until they're almost caught. There's that.
Okay, I can see why my parents
they also treat their relationship very, I would say, honestly, as cartoonish and as ridiculous and as like way hyperbolic as a lot of it would be, because this isn't based in reality. Springfield isn't based in reality. At least it really diverts in the season progression. They do have problems. There's a number of almost affairs, a lot of temptations, a lot of money issues that they fight about, a lot of trust issues that they fight about, a lot of personal conflict that with child rearing, with how they handle the kids, how they handle which of the kids, friends. It's all very full. They have a very full relationship in a way that I think is very different from a lot of shows that it would be compared to, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because obviously I haven't watched The Simpsons in a very long time. And when I did, I was much younger. So the characters that I obviously gravitated towards were Lisa and Bart. And those are most of my memories of The Simpsons. Like, when I think about Homer Simpson, like, obviously the meme is of him eating a donut or him strangling
his
son.
Which has changed over the years. It is core Simpsons, that element, but eventually even the show sort of settled into the times. That doesn't happen anymore.
Interesting. Yay, well, getting I mean, rid of child abuse.
They call attention to it. Like, there's the whole episode which is based on Behind the Music, which was a show on VH1 about, you know, rock stars. And they had a whole concept about how they were just filmed. Like, it was a TV show and they were playing themselves, essentially. And they mentioned the strangling part. And Homer says, and that horrible act of child abuse became one of our most beloved gags. And it's like, you hang that lampshade so the audience knows you're aware of it, so that it's not as terrifying, you know.
Yeah.
It's not cruel anymore. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, because I think it's ending soon, but like, The Simpsons has been gone on for so long that it's sort of a parody of a parody of a parody of itself.
There's a whole trope based around that called Flanderization, which is when a character becomes so much of itself.
Mm-hmm.
If you look, and that's based on the character Flanders, where he is so much a more well-rounded human being in the earlier seasons, and at this point, that's debatable when that time ends, when earlier means, but I would say in the first 10 years. And then now it's almost like he has no depth because they've made him into a cartoon. Ironically.
So what, obviously you got into a little bit about what you like about Marge and Homer's mm-hmm. relationship. And like, we kind of think of them as like one of the first like American cartoon couples,
in a way, they're based on a template. I mean, there's a reason that's like the two parents, the two and a half kids, which they also bring up in episodes. But it's the concept of the fat slob guy and the pretty wife. That is a concept that has existed since the Honeymooners and the Flintstones and Roseanne and Mary with Children and King of Queens, and I could keep on going. And while the shapes of those people have changed over the years, because you can now be, Married with Children, technically he's not in the same body shape, but so they can play with it a little bit. But the concept of like the guy who's a dick and the well-meaning snarky wife is a long-standing trope. One of the ways the show subverts it is that Homer is oftentimes presented as either being very well-meaning, but something is actually wrong with him and he cannot express it properly. And Marge is kind. She very rarely is snarky. She doesn't get the zingers in. And it's actually very often when she tries, it's funny for the wrong reason, because she's the heart. She's the heart of that show. And Homer is the id. I think when that show began, they planned for Bart to be the id, where everything just, he would just do whatever the hell he wanted and things would blow up and things would go. But eventually there's only so much a 10-year-old can do in a show. Homer as an adult, he can travel, he can get a different job, he can do things that have more lascivious tones and it'd be better, it'd be okay, it'll play better. So he's really the adult id. And then you have Lisa, who's like the voice of reason, but a know-it-all. Marge is the voice of reason, but kind and almost naive to a fault. She gets hurt in the course of it, but it's always in the best of intention that she means well and she hopes for the best of humanity.
That's actually kind of really sweet.
I think it is. I think that if you look at a lot of the shows individually, or if you look at the concept of the shows individually, it is very easy to paint it with a very broad stroke, so to speak. But I think that the relationship building that the show has gone out of its way to do, particularly in the first 15 seasons, is and Homer is by no means, I'm not saying that he's a great guy. He has a lot of flaws, and Marge has a lot of flaws. And I think it's very important to recognize that characters that we appreciate and that we identify with or that we respond to are supposed to be flawed. And they're not supposed to be, because they're meant to reflect us. They're meant to reflect humanity. And as stupid as that may potentially sound to someone who's talking about, you know, two-dimensional yellow characters, this show has always dealt with that. It dealt with child abuse in the first season. It dealt with childhood depression in the first season. It dealt with characters who didn't know if they were going to make their rent. These are real life issues that the show handles on their own terms. And that's why I get a little, again, academic or self-righteous about my feelings for it, because I do think it's done a lot of work to make that, you know, real.
Yeah, I think, well, because, I mean, obviously, like, I think when I think of The Simpsons, I also think of, like, shows that came after it and were very much in that sort of mm-hmm. model, like Family Guy, but were not nearly, I mean, from what you're describing, like, we're not nearly as sincere and, like, trying to have sort of a mm-hmm. human connection and backbone throughout
well,
the whole plot.
Well, I think something like Family Guy is almost at the point where The Simpsons switched, because then I think it started to respond to that kind of show, Family Guy. And Family Guy is really a pop culture schmear under the guise of a family comedy, in my estimation. I think it's more about the punchlines and the jokes mm-hmm. and not really about mm-hmm. who these characters are to each other. And that's fine. That's totally valid as a show, and I think even Seth MacFarlane would agree that they probably spend more time on references and cutaways than they would on, you know, real character development. It's just not their jam. But they can surprise you. I think The Simpsons has probably a little bit more in common with something like Bob's Burgers. It has a little bit more of the heart mm-hmm. and the sense of family dynamic in that way, and all the good and bad that comes with that.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just having a lot of feelings. I didn't know I could have feelings about The Simpsons.
Surprise. Yeah, my only feelings about The Simpsons to date are that my sibling has a t-shirt with Bart Simpson slowly transfiguring himself into Garfield. And it upsets me viscerally every time I visit for Christmas and they're wearing that
shirt.
They
wear it every Christmas? That's their Christmas shirt?
They wear it almost every time I come to visit. But yeah, it always comes out when I visit over the Christmas holiday. It's, yep. Merry Christmas. Here's Garfield and Bart. Yeah. So what are your favorite tropes for Marge and Homer's relationship?
Not to like spill the beans on, you know, the show Bible of your show, but I was given like a little alert of what you're talking about. And I wasn't sure if you wanted my favorite tropes in general or my favorite tropes that apply to them.
Oh, gotcha.
Okay.
I mean, we'll take both.
As I said before, one of the things that I really respond to is the relationship aspect between them. I think the relationship aspect is that they are complementary opposites. They're not in conflict opposites, because they both fulfill a need in each other. And so again, I think that is subversive to the general trope of, you know, slob and hot wife. I mean, I think that's frequently what we miss in a lot of those pairings. My favorite tropes in general, I'll have to say, is again coming up from viewing things from a unsatisfied queer vision of, you know, media. I was very responsive to the evil bisexual trope and the depraved homosexual trope, femme fatales, like characters that were generally women, frankly, that were Disney villains or superhero villains, things like that, because they were just a little bit more exciting, a little bit more interesting. They dressed a little better. I also love a crazy old broad like Bette Davis in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, or anything that Bette Davis has done. I love drunk and honest fights that happen in the context of like one night, like between two, like an old married couple, like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. I just love banter. I love banter. And I love quick back and forth. And while those elements aren't directly in The Simpsons, there are pieces that are referenced because the writers of The Simpsons, and there's a variety of them. I mean, Conan O'Brien used to write for The Simpsons. There's a number of people who have gone on to other things. And they're recognizing the tropes of the world and the tropes of other media and then responding to it, I think is really cool. So you have the pop culture responses. So for example, since I like, you know, gay characters, they had John Waters on and they had to address that. We have no real concept of how Homer Simpson feels about homosexuality. And so he has to suddenly deal with that. And John Waters plays another character, not John Waters. He plays another fictional character. And Homer suddenly realizes he's homophobic. And the episode goes into the concept of him handling that. And why is that? Is that because he's afraid of his own femininity, which frankly he has a lot of. Homer is by no means extraordinarily he-man-ish. He says at one point he can't even say the word titmouse without giggling like a schoolgirl. Just like that. Just like that. So it gives you that, and Marge is like, what's the problem? You have to realize you're being ridiculous about that. So again, Marge is the kind voice of reason and not necessarily, but still naive enough to not necessarily understand the motivation in Homer's phobia. So when Lisa has challenged her on religious matters, there's a possibility that an angel skeleton was, it makes sense in context, I promise. An angel skeleton was found in Springfield, and Lisa's like, that's not scientific. And Marge is like, listen, at some point you have to take a leap of faith. And even though, spoiler alert, it turns out the angel is a falsehood, it's not really an angel skeleton, Marge's point is made. You sometimes have to assume that things are not, you know, always going to be understood by you, and that's okay. You have to not immediately be so angry and divide yourself from the opinion of, don't necessarily have to be so contrarian automatically. And then, I mean, then it also plays with a lot of the guest stars, a lot of the relationship aspects. I'm really fond of a lot of, especially the classic voice work that was done in the show. Like some fantastic people did that show in the earlier years. It eventually became sort of a, well, then who hasn't? But there are still people who haven't, who never have and never will. But to answer your question, I don't know.
Good answer. Very well rounded.
Can you tell I studied? I studied.
Yeah, I didn't know that was much Simpsons to study, so I'm like, I'm impressed and I have learned so much.
There's like 30 years of Simpsons.
And I will be very honest. I have not consumed the most recent seasons. I am probably 5 to 6 seasons out. I've explored a few episodes. So there was an episode that RuPaul appeared in and I felt I needed to see that to see how they would handle it. So I did dip in. It is a show that while there is established continuity, it's not necessarily a show fully, sometimes it is, where you have to have watched everything to get something. They will do a lot of callbacks, but they'll help the audience out. Like, so if you don't know that Flanders had a wife who died, it will come up again at some point. If you don't know that, I don't know, Bart used to have an elephant, it will come up again. And it will usually come up in a conversation that, again, lampshades it or lets the audience know, wink, we know we've been on for a million years. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that is the joke, is that everything happened on The Simpsons. Right. Well, that was the thing South
Park said. And South Park said that like 20 years ago. It's even more true now. To the point where we can say, oh, Simpsons predicted. Well, sort of. What they did was they said this was a possible ridiculous conclusion. It just happens to be that we're living in an age of ridiculous conclusions.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think is the sort of controversies surrounding Marge and Homer a couple?
The general one would be simply that Homer doesn't deserve Marge, that he is stupid, that he is harmful or toxic in some way, and that Marge deserves better. And while I can't speak to the fact that if he were a real person, that may be true, the fact that they are not real people is actually a really, really useful in potentially defending that aspect. We are only given, and again, fandom or fan fiction notwithstanding, we are only given the facts as they are presented to us. So the fact that the show only presents a certain side of how Homer and Marge react in their world, in their context, I think you have to take into consideration as not being part of our direct world. While it reflects, you know, Earth, in its work, it's still Springfield, which is its own identity, its own reality, and things work a certain way there. And I mean, they have basically said that there are space aliens who sometimes visit Springfield. You just sort of have to accept that that's part of the reality. And you could say, well, that's not canon, but then that would contradict the other stuff that doesn't contradict this. I mean, there's a lot. So Homer being an irresponsible person, I think it's more complicated than that, because the show has had opportunities to express that there are a lot of roots to why he is the way that he is, and also what it means to be the way that he is. So he is someone who, throughout the course of the series, it has been told that his mother left when he was very young and disappeared because she was a 60s radical. His father lied to him and didn't tell him that his mother was gone or that his mother ran away, instead told him that she died. That sounds really harsh, just saying that out loud, but the way that the show contextualizes it, you are given permission to even feel bad about his father if you want to. It gives you the option for making that decision and telling Homer that. It also says that Homer's low intelligence is based on a number of factors, not the least of which is radiation that Springfield has, not the least of being raised by a father who did not know how to connect to him as a child. Because when his mother left, he clearly changed he just couldn't connect. And the show does this in flashbacks and shows this even wordlessly. There's a whole scene where they do a parody of one of the YouTube videos of like taking a picture of yourself every day and it going rapid fire while like slow piano music plays. They do this, and the backgrounds of that show him as a child and his father just sitting sullenly at the kitchen table and them not connecting. And it does that for like four frames. And that's pretty heady stuff. That isn't a gag, that isn't a joke, but would, you know, connect to that. We also, I mean, but also he also shoved a crayon up his nose as a child. So that also had some effect on his potential intelligence. But clearly he is well-meaning, if inept at a certain point. And again, which of us is not? He has a tough time paying attention to things. Like he doesn't listen to the individual words. And I think he says that at one point, that he just listens to the gist of things. And that the problem is that his brain doesn't let him get there. And if you want to, and there have probably been, you know, essays written about this, or theses, he represents the way that some people can be. And he's a loving person, but he shows a well-rounded aspect of kind of being inept, kind of being thoughtless, except, you know, at pivotal points, but also still being worthy of love. And Marge is there because nobody else would have him. And as many times as we are shown that Homer would have temptation, there's a character named Mindy who was played by Michelle Pfeiffer, who I mentioned earlier, actually. And there's a chance that Homer could fall in love with her. There's another character that he's named Luann, and there's a chance, Lurleen rather, and there's a chance that he could fall in love with her because these two women happen to be attracted to him. It doesn't show that Homer is incapable of being attracted to, but none of either of those women could ever stand him the way that Marge does, contextually speaking. And I'm taking a leap there because I can. Marge has the opportunity to leave Homer when somebody else comes forward as a possibility, but he doesn't need her the same way that she gets fulfillment out of being married to Homer. And you could say that it's codependent. You could say that Marge doesn't have an identity, but frankly, that's not true. There are just as many episodes where Marge has stuff to do. She gets jobs. She has activities. She travels. There are still things she does. Is it in the context of being a wife and mother? Very often. But that doesn't mean, and is she fulfilling, like fully fulfilled? And never, I don't know. It's 22 minutes. What do you want from me? There's only so much resetting they can do. But the way that they truly need each other is, I think, important to recognize, because I don't know if anyone would love Marge as much as Homer does because of the way that he needs her.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where it's great to envision what a perfect mm-hmm. relationship would look like. And it's of course, you want to put depictions on TV that are aspirational for if what humans could be and what humans could do.
That's a relatively new concept. Want,
at the same time. Yeah, right. And I also think at the same time, yeah, okay, shoot for the stars, but you have to also meet people where they are and, you know, be realistic about the kinds of relationships that people actually do have and how you can work and do your best in that framework in your everyday life. Yeah.
I mean, and that's also them. I mean, that's a very, I know I talked for a long time, but that's a very rudimentary understanding of what they have. I mean, you could technically go episode to episode and say, and I won't, and say, what have we, like, what is the overall connection that will then take these two characters that are in love? Why does that take them to the next episode or the next episode? Are the episodes airing in order? There's some debate in the fandom that it's not, that we also hit a reset button, because at one point they went to high school in the 70s, because that's what made sense when that show aired in the 80s. Now we have to recognize that if they're still 37, 38, 39, which they are, well, hell, that means they met in college. Or wait, no, that means this. So the more, you know, calisthenics that the show makes to try to keep up to date, it gets a little murky, and that's where the storytelling falls apart. And unfortunately, a lot of the heart falls apart. But I'm not necessarily mad at the episode where we find out that they were in the 90s. I'm not really all that mad about it, because I think it was still a pretty decent episode.
So what do you think you have learned about relationships from Marge and Homer, and how do you think that has impacted your own relationships?
I think the general concept of overanalyzing and being critically analytic about who they are as, you know, non-people and since they are, it is a show that I grew up with and still watch on Disney Plus, because it's a show that still resonates with me, even if I've seen it a lot. Like, I've seen every episode up until, you know, recently, and many times, some a lot more than others. So it allowed me to take a fandom that was accessible to me and deconstruct it, which I've always found very satisfying, which is really what I was doing when I was making fan fiction at like 7 years old, is I was taking an existing fandom and then somehow interpreting it to fit my needs. And since the show has so much world, has so many characters, and so many reference points to work with, because it involves multi-generational characters, it involves characters, some who are married, some who are not, some who are gay, some who are heterosexual, some who are old, some who are rich, some who are extraordinarily poor. Since it has all of those facets, you can really pick a lot in that show. And I can understand, and I've had friends who Homer was the stumbling block. They like everything else except for him. And that's cool. That's fine. I know people who love that show but can't stand Lisa because she's so self-righteous. I get it. I would then think about why that bothers you, because I think there's a lot to deconstruct there. But I think that show helped me not only as a potential writer myself work on world building and take on two frivolous characters potentially and really put some analysis on their motivations, which is rough when they're cartoons and they have a lot of writers. But decisions were made. And if you believe in canon, well, you have to somehow justify that. And that's okay. Or you say, you know, that's an element I don't like. That's cool. There's a lot of people that I like who I don't like an element about them. Directly, it has taught me a lot about, it was one of the first shows I ever saw that addressed infidelity. I am a child of divorce. It was one of the first times that I saw on TV characters getting divorced. Bart's best friend, Milhouse, his parents gets divorced. And devastatingly, if I were to just read what's on the tin for that, it doesn't sound funny. But the show manages to make it work. And I would say a great deal of patience, also implied from, and also trying to understand motivations. I don't think it's a great idea to question your partner's motivations as to why they're doing something, but to consider why that's important to them, why that's important to you. And I think that they're a great example of two potentially caustic character personality types that just still make a lot of sense together. I'm neither of them. I don't think that's a problem, but I think I can still identify with that.
Huh. You really did, research
this. I spent most of my life researching it by accident, but I did make some notes. I did write some notes just to make sure I had some specific talking points, but... this is how I feel, and no one's ever asked me that question before.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm glad we are absolutely happy to ask that question. And to be fair, I think that this might be one of like the densest shows we've discussed on this podcast so far. I mean, I don't think any of the other shows we've talked about have a backlog going back 30 years. I mean, because we have done an episode on Kirk and Spock, but it was specifically about the original series. So even in that case, it was, you know, contained. Whereas you, I mean, you've had the most material to consider when giving your report.
And well, just think how exhausting it is for me, because I feel this way about everything I like.
That must be. I do understand.
I mean, you are one of us, my friend.
I mean, if you want to get into like the whole like homosexuality interesting thing about Mr. Green and Clue, I could go into this.
I mean, I'm not opposed to that at all. Another time. That should absolutely happen. Another time. So in closing then, what is it that draws you back to this ship or to fandom?
Well,
in general?
I mean, this show... and again, specifically the show, not necessarily just Homer and Marge, but the show itself is comfort food. It does deal with a lot of trauma, but in a palatable way. and it handles things in a imperfectly indelicate but consumptive way. I think that it just I mean, that's a lot of buzzwords just to simply mean that it's calming and it's friendly. And it's not overly intellectual, so it doesn't come across as of too heavy-handed. It has the opportunity to a lot because it does deal with a lot of topics that are, you know, dicey. But I, for the most part, I think it is extraordinarily successful in how it executes those discussions. And it doesn't all the time, in fact, very frequently, have a final thought. It just says, this is what happened. And like one episode, they're talking about, so what's the moral of all this? And Marge tries a couple platitudes, but none of them fit. And Lisa says, well, maybe there is no moral. And Homer says, exactly, it's just a bunch of stupid stuff that happened. Because sometimes life is just a bunch of stupid stuff that happened. Because I believe particularly the first 15 seasons, and I think a lot of people would say at least the first 10 seasons, are very well written. They hold up. A lot of references that they make still make sense. It's not, my favorite show is in fact The Golden Girls, but I will take into account that a lot of the references on The Golden Girls are very dated, very regional Florida humor, but it still works, mm-hmm. But it's very dated. A lot of Simpsons is not dated. Outside of things that may have happened in the world. So if they mentioned Richard Nixon being alive, yes, obviously that's not true anymore. But then you have, it's written in such a way that it's very quotable. You can say a lot of things, you can work it in. I can do this for days. If someone says something, I can find a Simpsons quote that connects to it. Because again, there are just that many words. So it's available, and it's kind, as mean as some of the characters might present. So Bart is a hellraiser. Marge nags. Homer is a doofus at times. There's a school bully. Bad things happen. It's never cruel, which is one of the problems that I had with Family Guy, which I watched. I watched mm-hmm. for a number of years, and I can literally tell you the scene I turned off, that I was like, I'm done. And it's a weird, why was that the final one? It's completely inconsequential to some of the worst things that they did. But for some reason, I was like, you know what? I'm good. And I don't find that happening. I don't find that occurring in The Simpsons, and particularly in the relationship of Homer and Marge. They don't hate each other. There are too many sitcoms where the husband and wife don't belong together because all they do is fight, are unsatisfied sexually, and like to draw attention to the fact that they have terrible, terrible flaws. That's not funny to me. So Homer and Marge don't do that. They simply don't.
Good. Fucking good. That's what gets me excited about a show. Like, do the characters actually like each other? Right, we're
they can
in
have
business.
Conflict, but to basically bring up, there's always a reference for everything. The episode where Milhouse's parents break up, it's based on a fight where they are just vicious at each other. And the reason it works is because they're secondary characters. They are who we're looking at through the eyes of Marge and Homer. So we're allowed to see them be awful to each other and not get stuck on that. We're allowed to find it. Yeah,
there's a buffer there.
And don't get me wrong, again, like I said, banter, yeah. Like who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf has two characters who are fucking awful, because sometimes that is what the media calls for. But you walk into that play, or you put on that movie, or you read that play knowing that that's what you're getting from these characters. They're kind of anti-heroes. In this case, they're just people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. The Simpsons, they're just people.
They're yellow, but they're people.
They
only have four fingers.
Sometimes Bart turns into Garfield.
That's
He's still
not
people.
Canon. And I know I said I haven't watched the last six seasons, but I'm going to go on a limb and I'm going to say it's still not canon. I also have absolutely no understanding why those two characters would be blended into each other because they have nothing in common, but that's neither here nor there.
I have no idea. I guess the artist just thought what
the 90s. The 90s?
Yeah, yes. Well,
the 90s
merge the 90s pop culture into one pizza eating monster. Great.
Have you created fan content for this ship, or what sort of fan content would you like to see made for The Simpsons in the year 2020?
Like I said, I've written stuff all along. I didn't. Now you're making me think. So there was a season cliffhanger. Where the character of Mr. Burns, the town's billionaire, gets shot. And the question becomes, who shot Mr. Burns? And inevitably, the question is sort of moot, because who wouldn't? A, he's a terrible person. He just did a terrible thing. And a lot of people that we are more friendly with are suspects. But how it handles that, it was a cliffhanger in the season finale, and then you have the entire summer where they did, and this is how dated it is, they had like a 1-800 collect tie-in so that you could call in and guess who did it. They had a whole contest, and then
multimedia experience.
If you're ever curious, and this is documented, the person who won the contest was supposed to be inserted into the show, and he never claimed his prize. After all that, they got the answer right, and they still just didn't disappear. I don't remember off the top of my head if they declined it or if they could never find them, but it just never happened. So after all that, it just never happened.
Ominous.
But it's like a famous failure in marketing that's like legendary in the TV world. That's to say that during the summer, before the season premiere announced who shot Mr. Burns, I made a list of every single character in Springfield, and I gave my reasons why it was and why it wasn't. And again, I don't think I could have done that had I not had Clue first, because Clue made put who, what, where in my head. But yes, and I ask you, who was reading that? No one. There was no internet to post that to. I didn't have the friends that gave a fuck like I did about this. My parents may have listened to me every now and then about it, but they weren't connected. Yes. I did all of that on, pre-Microsoft Word. I'll tell you that right now. I think it was called Word Perfect. Just a word processing.
Oh my God, you didn't even have Clippy there to support you.
No. He in fact did not see that I am writing a manifesto. Can he help me? Exactly. So yes, technically, yes, I have. I think I tried some short fiction with it, but can't improve upon it. So I don't think I ever really kept going. So yeah. I was more interested in superheroes at that time. Writing for them. So I did a bunch of X-Men stuff. Mm. Yeah. I think that the only thing that I would, I don't know if I'd ever really seek it out. I mean, every once in a while, someone will do like their own version of the couch scene of where they run out, where they do the whole town opening scene, or that they then end up on the couch. Because the couch gag is...
I have seen a couple of those during the quarantine.
The couch gag is iconic because it changes every episode. And sometimes they're very long, and you can tell that they did not have enough content for the rest of the show. And sometimes they are like really clever and really smart. So every once in a while, people will do their own. I saw a really dark animated fandom of I don't know, it wasn't really the couch gag per se, but they were on the couch, and it was sort of like infused with the movie You're Next. So they were basically killed, basically, and really gruesomely. And it was really like, Jesus Christ, like they were trying really hard. It was like The Aristocrats, like they were trying really hard to push the envelope. And then like there's a whole famous creepypasta of Bart dying in an episode, and the creator Matt Groening saying, "I can't let this out." So they canned it and they buried it, and then it ended up on the internet cursed, and it's this, and it's not real. But it's like this.
That's the episode where he turns into Garfield. It was supposed to happen.
But it's like legendary. Like if you search for Simpsons Bart's Dead or Simpsons Creepypasta, you'll find it. And because of technology, people can readdress that and make their own. Like, so people have made their own version of the video using existing footage. It's all, you know, low budget. But right. Yeah, that can be fun. I can't say that I didn't spend at least an afternoon looking up the creepypasta stuff, because that's just fascinating to me that people like would spend so much time building that world. That was neat to me.
Constructing a legend. Yeah.
So I'm cool with that. That's fine. Yeah.
Nice.
That's constructive.
So our final question of the evening, to try to, I guess, lighten it up after creepypasta and censorship, is what makes you think of the ship of Homer and Marge?
I'm able to see so many deconstructions. I quote them on the regular. Unfortunately, I married a man who not only indulges that, but will participate, because that wasn't promised to me. They actually have in the late 80s, they had an album that was released called Simpsons Sing the Blues. And it was a very strange, very esoteric, very specific concept where the Simpsons went into a recording studio and sang jazz blues songs. Why this was greenlit, I have no idea. Why this made it through multiple marketing meetings, this made it through the cast actually coming together and doing, because it's all their voices, it's all them. Hank Azaria and Julie Kavner and Dan Castellaneta and Yardley Smith and Nancy Cartwright and Harry Shearer. It's all of them. And they're singing songs as their characters. So, and they're varying quality. They're varying quality. Lisa does a very pretty version of God Bless the Child, which was originally done by Billie Holiday. It's a very strange idea. It's like, again, just saying it out loud just doesn't make any sense sometimes. But there's a song that Homer and Marge sing together, and it's called I Love to See You Smile. And it's, I don't know, I don't think that it was written for the show. I don't have the liner notes in front of me, but I don't think it was written for the album, but it might be a cover. But it's so cute and it's so sweet. And it's an example of two characters who are in love just sort of addressing that in song, and very inarticulately. It's not a clever song. It's barely a funny song. It's mostly just cute. But it's just so pure. It's so pure. And I think it's a great jumping off point from there on, that any sweetly romantic or just pure affection song or music or what have you that can be connected will always bring you back to a character ship like that, if not them specifically. And then of course they have a song, their wedding song or their relationship song is They Long to Be Close to You by the Carpenters, which they controversially, and I say that in quotes because nobody cares, try to rewrite in one episode to You Light Up My Life by Anne Murray, but it doesn't stick because in later episodes, it's confirmed that it was in fact They Long to Be Close to You by the Carpenters.
Oh my God. I've just been silently like having a giggle attack over here over how inside baseball that is, and I just never in my life did I ever know any of that. And I would have had no way of, I feel like that's information I never would have stumbled
it's
on
not
if
essential.
You hadn't told
it's
me.
It's not essential by any means, but I'm glad to have brought it to you.
Thank you. Yeah, Yes, thank you for all
You're
of
welcome.
This. This
has thank been, you for asking.
Absolutely. This is the most I've ever known about The Simpsons. I feel much more at one with the pop culture universe now.
Well, again, it's a show that, since there is so much you can pick and choose, it's something that's, it's again, it's part of the friendliness and accessibility of it. You can just get along with just knowing steamed hams. You can just get along knowing Eat My Shorts. Like it doesn't, it's all a rich tapestry, mm-hmm. which is a Simpsons quote.
Amazing. On that wonderful note, If you our listeners have any feelings about The Simpsons that you'd love to share with us, you can tweet us at defendyourship, and you can also send us an email at defendyourship@gmail.com. Victor, do you have anything you'd like to plug?
Well, you can always find me on the internet. So I Instagram is Victor Devonne, VikTorDevonne. Also check out WE Burlesque on Instagram, on Twitter, and on your podcast platform of choice. It is a weekly conversation with burlesque people and nightlife people. Right now, I am in a sub-series of it where I talk to a bunch of performers who are, frankly, not working a whole lot because of quarantine. So we're discussing how we're getting through it. And as a friend and colleague once said, it's like listening to two friends on the phone on a three-way call and they're ignoring you. So I like to do that. And I also am a content creator. I have a series called Two Night Stay. That's the number 2, NIGHT, stay. It is a haunted hotel found footage, murder, mystery, ghost story anthology thing that is written and recorded. And it features the vocals of several burlesque people as well, because those are all the people that I know. So check that out too.
Amazing.
This was delightful. I'm still
excellent.
Not over it. This
well,
was delightful.
Helping myself and outdoing it next time.
I can't believe I got wrecked by The Simpsons.
That's going to be the episode title. I can't believe I got wrecked by The Simpsons.
Then my job here is done.